Good morning, everybody. This is IT Live, brought to you by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Texas Homer. That, to my side, is Ian Boyd. We have some fun stuff to discuss today. We're actually going to discuss the deep passing game for Texas and what Arch can do to help that against the scourge of defensive coordinators solving for a lot of these concepts. We're going to see what Arch can do to help us. We're also going to talk about what does Taft look like at that nickel spot? What does that actually mean? Does he stick there? Does he not? All of that kind of stuff. Good morning to everyone. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Yeah, got the haircut, boys. You know what's up. Got the mirrors lowered. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Had to get them detailed. And they kept the beard long enough, man. I always tell them, like, don't take off too much, and they normally do, but it's all good. You taking a good look? And then how's the mic today, boys? Don't lie to me. We did some adjustments, so the mic should be good. Mine was tripping out yesterday.
Do you not have a beard trimmer?
I do, man, but like I said, man, I really like that kind of through hiker chic look, dude. I just like to let it ride.
Somebody asked a good question. More Dan asked a great question that maybe you could put. Where's Ian's Academy swag? I had the same question.
Yeah, Ian was quite upset. I guess for some reason he was off that text thread when we got our shirts and we didn't realize it. And Ian has been upset.
They have a thread that has everyone except me and Paul. That's obviously where they go to complain about me and Paul and how jealous they are of our amazing talent. And then they accidentally use that for the Academy swag handouts.
Yeah,
if we get more sponsorships or more sponsorship gifts, and this happens again, Connor, I'm going to throw an absolute fit.
I will make sure that the sponsors hook you up. Yeah, the Yeti I just use for these lives, my actual like professional mic's the RE20. Like, so for like Homer videos and stuff like that, it's my favorite mic in the game. It's just a little bit difficult with the live setting sometimes. It doesn't work as well, so I have to use the Yeti for all you guys that are gear nerds. All right, boys. So we had a question from this gentleman as well to start the morning. His first question, and then we'll get into Arch and we'll get into Taft. He asked this morning on the board, oh yeah, by the way, sign up on the board, guys. InsideTexas.com. Best recruiting, all the news. Team news is going crazy right now. And of course, if you ask your question on the board, you'll either get it answered by the mods right there, or you guys can get it answered on the channel. So join Inside Texas right now, $1 for your first week. As a bonus, your membership includes a complimentary year to The Athletic. Also, buy Paul's book. I don't want to tell you guys again. Buy it. 2025 Longhorn Football Perspectives, Thanking Texas Football. All the links in the description. Best team preview for Texas, SEC, all of that. You will not regret it. All right, so question one was, Texas had the best game plan against Ohio State. Could you dumb it down for me while being specific? How did we largely shut down Jeremiah Smith, and how does that translate to this year?
They basically copied what Michigan has done 4 years in a row against Ohio State, which is play two deep coverages primarily, so you can bracket the most dangerous slot or the slot receiver and the most dangerous outside receiver. And then you trust your front six to hold up against the run without bringing extra defenders down to answer the run game. The reason that other teams do not do this is that they cannot. Like, Ohio State will run over most teams and just out-talent them in the run game if you try to do that. But they could not do that against Michigan for the last 4 years. And they could not do that against Texas last year either. They played Texas pretty well. Like, they scored 21 points on offense.
Yeah, I watched it last night.
Opening drive was good. They hit some throws underneath on script before the script ran out. They ran the ball a couple times. But, yeah, Texas, two deep safety coverages. They also mixed in a lot of crazy Tampa 2 stuff, and which is like three deep and even more conservative. And they had some replacement blitzes, Connor, that I found on All-22. where they would like bring four and drop into quarters or Tampa two.
A lot of Tampa two. I was watching last night
with guys moving all over the place. So they won because they said, you're not going to beat us throwing a Jeremiah Smith and a Mecca Igbuka. You're going to beat us by running the ball. We dare you to do it. That's basically it.
They did a lot of inverted stuff too. You know, they'd bring the safety down and fly out Caleb Downs or fly. They were doing a lot of stuff where the players are moving in between zones and
not Caleb Downs. That would have been real.
So they would have him down in the low hole.
Ohio State?
Yeah, Ohio State.
We're talking about Texas defense. What are you talking about?
Oh, I thought we were talking Ohio State defense. It was our things.
No, I thought it was – no, it was Texas's defensive game plan against Ohio State.
Yeah. My bad. I was focused on what Ohio State was doing that was cool. So they would do Caleb Downs down in the low.
They had Caleb Downs. They would have actually won that game.
But what if I was like, Caleb Downs not on Texas? They would have him low in the low hole, and then they would just fly him out to like even a cover two or whatever. But they were just able to access stuff from all over, dude. It was I was able to watch the all 22 full game. It was on YouTube, and it was pretty cool what they were doing. Jeremiah Smith got left in some man situations more than I thought, but he was never targeted on it. It was just like a run play or whatever like that, and Jade would just hang out with him.
Yeah, that's you never play the same coverage all game. And by playing so much too high, Texas was able to sneak into single high a bunch of times without Ohio State already having a play dialed up to beat them deep with Smith. That's the way you do it.
You know what I've noticed too about Sark, like in our close games, our close losses, that I think is interesting. So like whenever it was time to go drive back right before Quinn gets sacked and we lose the game, Sark just like dials up three plays in a row and gets us right down there. And then I remember against Washington, Sark dialed up three plays and got us right down there. I can't remember if that was the case in SEC versus Georgia, but it felt like it was. So it's like Sark's holding back these beaters. And whenever he does want to turn it on, he turns it on really fast. But to me, it's like, what if we took two of those and put them a little earlier in the game, and then we could get down the field faster. But I'm going to go back and watch, because it seems like when it is time, really crunch time at the end, Sark dials up these plays.
How much of that also is that Quinn would be more aggressive late in the game? Because it's like, got to have it this time.
So, yeah, there's that part too. I'm not going to mention Quinn because I get accused of criticizing Quinn everything. So I'm not even going to mention it. But yeah, maybe there's a factor there. I can't relate to it, but maybe. But yeah, it's interesting. At the end of those games, even if we don't win, we drive right down the field in situations where we were struggling to get down the field as often. So it is cool. But that's the trick for Jeremiah State or Jeremiah Smith. And then Michigan did this kind of similar style. And Ian, before that game, was talking all about taking Michigan's game plan.
Yeah, I've been watching it closely for 4 years. I've been writing about it. It was getting funny. It was starting to become legitimately hilarious. Michigan would do almost the exact same thing every year, and Ohio State couldn't beat it. I kind of finally started to figure out why, but it's possible that Ohio State has adjusted this year. And if they have, and they're ready with their answer, then this game could be a real bummer.
All right. Well, let's see if we can figure some things out on our side.
I don't know. This fall camp, I was like, Texas 10-2, 11-1. Maybe get in the playoffs, see what happens. Now I'm like 10-2, 9-3. Hope that you get to the playoffs and have figured out some stuff by the end of the year. Right now, I think this team has a lot to figure out, a lot more than people realize.
Give me a quick rundown, just the list. You don't have to go into it.
Who's the star?
We'll talk about that. Yeah.
Does this team have enough coverage? It's been my thing for the last few months, and
enough versatility or just pure ability to execute. Enough
pure coverage players in the secondary. Yeah. And I'm not worried about long-term effects of Wingo's deal that's been holding him out. But I am worried that just see, stuff seems to be popping up a lot for him. Like he pulled his hammy in the spring. They obviously held him out mostly as a precaution. He has this deal in the fall. He'll be back, I don't know, today, tomorrow, something. Every time he actually plays, it seems like it's like, okay, he's going to be amazing. But it makes me nervous. I wonder if, because he's so big, he's like 6'2", 220, right? 6'2", 215. And I wonder if he just, you remember like LeBron James has issues sometimes with cramping. And he had this big finals game against the Spurs where the AC went out and he was cramping over and over and over again and kept coming out of the game. When you're that big and fast and you're moving with that much power, that's like a lot of stress on your body to be that big and fast and moving that fast so much, applying so much torque to your body. And it's also a big thing for soft tissue injuries. Like it's just very common to find guys that are freakishly powerful and fast of that size, like 6'2", 6'3", 230, 240, and to see them get injured a lot when they try to, like the Paul calls them like Lamborghinis.
Yeah, they're just wound tight.
Yeah, they're wound tight. They get out of the shop and they break down real fast.
Yeah. Always, you'll hear about that like in weightlifting, you know, like say someone becomes enhanced and they gain, you know, 30 pounds of muscle. So they're a lot stronger very quickly, but nothing else catches up, like the ligaments and all of that kind of stuff. So you end up getting these like soft tissue injuries in that world. And I wonder about that with just really powerful players that are gaining a lot of muscle and size very quickly. You know, you'll hear somebody gain 60 pounds and that's not Wingo, but you'll hear these kind of things often. And generally, your ligaments and all your soft tissue is not growing at the rate your muscle is growing. So that's always something I find interesting for those guys that put on a lot of weight because of that factor.
Yeah, that's common. In the 90s in baseball, when guys started doing roids a ton, all these trainers and doctors around the league were like, what's with these? Like we're getting all these weird injuries where guys' muscles are like popping off the bone and wrist ligaments are busting and all sorts of crazy. Like we have never seen, what is happening? And it was exactly that. It was the guys were getting juiced up real big, real fast, and the body couldn't take it. What's up with this? Buzz Roy says that cramping take is BS. I don't know what he's referring to. This is a sidebar about LeBron James or if it's about Wingo or what. The point with LeBron is that LeBron, I don't know if you've seen LeBron, Buzz, you probably have. He's pretty famous.
He's heard.
He's like 6'8", 270. And at many points of his career, there have been many suggestions by various people that he was particularly enhanced.
Yeah.
So that's I'm not making any suggestions that Wingo is like that or anything. I just wonder.
No, I'm not talking about that with college guys. I'm just talking about the weight gain that you see from enhanced guys is a similar model for any players that pack on a ton of weight and size quickly.
Yeah. Somebody mentions OU. That I wonder if the thing is that if that was the problem for OU was that Schmitty was putting too much weight on these guys too fast, and that's why they keep getting injured in their fall camp. How come that wasn't happening to the OU in like the aughts with him or the teens, and how come it wasn't happening at A&M?
Yeah.
Like, it makes sense to me that Schmitty may have something going wrong that keeps getting all these players hurt, but that being, I don't know what it would be, and I don't understand why it wouldn't have happened in his like 30 years previous, where he was, unless he's like changed something or OU's deal is really weird. It's very curious to me how they keep having these injuries, and I don't know anywhere near enough about strength and conditioning or training or specifically what OU does to understand it. Although I do know that they are on the much more physical side in terms of how they do practices and preparation. So,
yeah, RC, you got to look at your drills too. You know, are you asking them to do things repeatedly that's like cutting too much? Are they putting too much pressure on their knees repeatedly throughout the day? Like, there's a lot of factors. And then there's just the statistical anomaly of your team gets hurt more than us. Like, there's going to be one, two teams every year that have that. It's just weird if OU has it back-to-back years. It's not a – but it's – I mean, there's always going to be a team like that, and sometimes it can happen to be OU, but it is pretty weird. Yeah, we just have a full show about how much of a cluster OU is right now. I just want a full hour of Ian and Paul shouting for it. I mean, we seem to get in like 10 minutes every show anyways, so I bet it adds up to about 7 hours of OU snark throughout the offseason so far.
Yeah, let's – we'll maybe hold off until they, like, lose to Michigan or Auburn, and then we'll go hog wild. No. Where were we talking about my concerns for Texas this year? That's what we were getting – that's what started
yeah,
this
Wingo, game. Yeah, Wingo was your last piece.
No star yet. That could be something that they figure out by the end of the year.
Yeah, and star is a nickel.
If they don't lose too many games first. So it's not like the end of the world, but I have some concerns there. I have concerns about if Wingo is going to be – like, so much rides on Wingo being amazing this year. Yeah. That's why – that's partly why they've been so cautious with him. It's because they know that, like, this team has a different ceiling if that guy's healthy and full go. Livingston, I wonder how good exactly Livingston can be. Maybe that –
Eric was saying on his notes, or no, in the Q&A this morning, that he thinks Livingstone is his bet for the starter right now.
They're at different spots, right?
Well, no, over Mosley is what I'm saying. So
We'll see. And then they had an interesting deal. Eric said they had a different set the other day where they tried Mosley at the slot. Mm-hmm. More in Wingo spot in Livingston outside. Isn't it Livingston? I thought it looks like it should be Livingstone, but I thought I heard in an interview he said it's Livingston.
Maybe. I don't know. I haven't heard him say it. I just remember saying it how it reads.
Somebody in chat, go listen to him say it for us and then come back and tell us the right answer. Receiving tackle in general. I don't know if Kojo was really going to be that important this year, but we already knew tackle depth was a little bit of a
concern. He's important in that regard, for sure.
I don't know if he would have been the third tackle or not, but if he could have been and now he can't, that hurts. And then, I don't know, just in general, I just feel like this team is just kind of young. It just seems like it might be a year away from really – oh, yeah, and then also the thing I always hammer over and over again is Homer knows. Two most important positions are wide receiver and defensive tackle.
And I feel a lot better about defensive tackle.
I feel the same like I felt all offseason.
I don't. I feel way better.
I've never thought they're going to be a liability. Because I watched, like, Brevard's film, I watched Shaw's film, and I was like, they're going to keep Texas from being bad. They're going to be very.
They're going to be good, though. That's like my difference of, like, I didn't think they're just going to hold the wall. I think, like, they're going to be a good group, not a great, but good.
But I want great. If I'm chasing a national,
me too.
If I'm chasing a national championship, that's a spot. Like, I can be good at linebacker. I can be, like, smart at safety, but I want to be athletically dominant at defensive tackle. And I doubt that they're athletically dominant against top teams.
I think we might if the depth works out well too, because I think you could get 30 snaps from these guys.
I don't think these guys are going to turn into Georgia D tackles just if they get 30 snaps.
Yeah, well, George, yeah, that's a standard that, yeah, that'd be tough.
But that's the standard I want. And that's the reason I was super high on Texas, especially in 2023. And a little bit in 2024, is because they had, like, legit early round NFL dudes at defensive tackle. And if they don't have that, I think the drop off from that is a lot steeper than people realize.
All right, so you're worried about our coverage, our defensive tackles, our wide receivers, and our offensive line?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's it. No big deal, dude. Just that.
But I'm just not that worried that any of them are going to be bad.
Yeah.
I'm just worried that they're not going to be great. And those are the spots where I think it's most important to be great.
Yeah.
O-line less so. That's much lower on my list, but.
All right. Well, let's hear a word from our sponsor, Academy Sports and Outdoors.
All right. Who's ready?
I'm open.
Let's talk the deep passing game, Ian.
Well, this is optimistic right here. This is a shift into the optimism world.
Let's do it. The art of Arch Manning's bomb throwing, baby. Let's get it. Okay. So what's your opening thesis here, Ian? Let the people know. Sark's background with quarterbacks.
Texas has not thrown bombs like previous Sark teams. I only showed the two Alabama teams, which is maybe a little unfair because those teams were obviously historically talented. But that is the bar. That is what Texas is aiming for, so why not? The drop-off in yards per attempt from the Alabama quarterbacks to the Texas quarterbacks is so big, especially when you're talking about a team that's so heavy into play action and RPOs.
Yeah, it's a shot team.
If you're below 9 yards per attempt, like something is not clicking the way it should. Yeah, Ryan says Ian is still perplexed that Casey Thompson is still the best Texas deep thrower of the Sark era. Technically, 23 Quinn beat him out, but yeah, Casey landed a lot more shots than anybody else that's played quarterback at Texas, except for Arch Manning.
Yeah. So we've had kind of a governor on the offense, haven't been able to get downfield as much as we want, both through like completions, like ability to actually when we throw it, but also this over-reliance on checkdowns at times. That's been a difference. But we got a new quarterback in, and what does that mean for us?
Well, Arch has proven that he's really good at it. Like 10.4 yards per attempt last year. In spot duty. Like you assume that can go up. If the receivers are good enough and Wingo is healthy, you assume that can go up. Now that he's had a full offseason getting plays designed and tailored specifically for him and getting all those QB1 reps and attention from Sark. So this is very promising that Texas could actually finally unlock the offense.
Yeah, because a lot of the scheme is building up to these moments, you know. Sark is purposely running the ball or throwing screens and trying to force looks and get guys down so you have these good looks for these shots.
Yeah.
And you would frustratingly often see Sark putting in all this leg work of really, frankly, inefficient in the moment plays so he could make up for all that yardage with one shot. And then we would routinely, either it would be there for whatever reason, the quarterback would pass up on it and check down, or we would just miss, either due to a quarterback missing or wide receiver miscommunication. So it was tough all year watching Sark build these crescendos, and then they didn't work. So now you're just running a ton of inefficient stuff, and you don't even get the payoff. But Arch is, A, hyper willing to throw that and will throw it. And on top of that, he's more accurate. Hopefully, now we just got to make sure that he's synced up with the wide receivers better. But Ian was able to speak to Bamonte, who is basically our assistant quarterback coach.
Sark's assistant.
Yeah. So he's like, Sark's really the quarterback coach, but then you have AJ Milway, who's the official quarterback coach, spends the most time with him, and then you have Bamonte under them. So Ian was able to speak with him at media availability and asked him some questions about Arch's ability to throw deep. So what does he say about Arch?
He said Arch is as good a deep ball thrower as I've been around.
But you can't make a living throwing deep on every play.
Yeah, sure. Whatever.
I know. I didn't say that. You should throw deep every play. That'd be awesome if you said that. But that's what we're saying is we weren't throwing deep every play. We were throwing screens every play to try to throw deep, you know. But the big thing is Arch is a good deep ball thrower.
Yes.
And then this is what you had on his play action stats from his games last year. So what was that? He was 18 for 28 on play action, throwing for 401 yards at 14.3 yards per attempt, three touchdown passes to a single interception.
Cool. Yep, pretty good. Kind of strange the touchdown passes wasn't a little bit higher.
Well, and a couple of those were drops, right? Like there was the Moore drop he had, and then there was the Jonte Cook drop, right? So a couple of those were there touchdowns, right?
I'm not sure if the Moore drop was play action.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that the
Cook one was.
I think that the Cook one was.
Yeah.
Because he threw some bombs on non-play action too, and he hit a bunch of those as well. He's great at throwing bombs. He throws the post good, as we're going to get into here. We're specifically focused on the post in this article. But the most famous bomb that Arch hit last year was that slot fade to DeAndre Moore.
Mississippi State, yeah.
He hit a couple fades, and he hit some fades in the spring game before 2023 too. He throws a beautiful fade. And the one that he hit one in practice that Kieran was noticing on X.com, where like there's like a towel in the end zone that looks like it's the landmark they're aiming for. And I don't think it was Livingston. I think it was somebody else. It doesn't matter. The guy caught Arch's fade throw as his foot was like hitting the towel, which meant Arch put it
exactly on a perfect dot, yeah,
exactly on the freaking towel. So he's very good at those two.
Yeah. What do you think of landmark throwing?
It's awesome.
If you can hit it, it's great.
I think that's how college football works.
Yeah.
You throw to spots. This is why I'm always saying first law of quarterback play in college, receivers make the passer. You teach the quarterback to throw to the spot, and then you make sure that it's up to the receiver to make sure that he's there and the defender's not.
Explain what a landmark throw is, just like very basic.
Landmark means like on this particular concept, you're trying to throw to this spot on the field, and you're basically expecting your receiver to be there.
Yeah. So you can say, we're going to throw it deep on the opposite hash. We're going to throw it down the – you know, the red fade line for fades, that kind of stuff. Post, it can be something different, but it could actually be you're aiming for the field goal marker. But basically, you're not throwing to the receiver. You're throwing effective arm punts into which the receiver needs to be at the right spot. And that's why timing is super important. And receivers' routes are super important because that's how you're going to hit these big shots.
This, just to bring this back up again, because it's been – driving me nuts. There's been like this thing going around on X the last couple of days where people are showing Penix highlights against Texas, and Texas fans are like, I've never seen a quarterback torch us so badly before. He was on God mode that game. And it's like, well, actually, he was throwing to spots, and Texas's defenders were letting the receivers get there.
Yeah.
It was not – people are like, look, we were in blanket coverage, and it's like, that's not blanket coverage. Like when you're trailing the guy and
you're behind him and there's no one over top, you're getting
beat. It doesn't matter if you're close. If you're letting him get to the spot where they're throwing the ball, you can be close counts and horseshoes and hand grenades, not fades.
Yeah.
So,
he did have a good game though, man. He was
very good. He was a very, very good college quarterback.
Yeah.
He was like Klubnik. Did something very similar to Texas last year. There's like a handful. When you get to the playoffs, there's probably a handful of quarterbacks in each playoff that can do that to you if their receivers are good and you play like Texas did in that game. Like Nussmeier could probably do that to you. Mateer, I think, could maybe do that to you. Arch, Klubnik. I wonder if Ty Simpson will have that capacity. Julian Sain, potentially.
Nussmeier.
I said Nussmeier, I think, right? If Jackson Arnold made a leap, he has that kind of ability. Well, there's a bunch of you gotta do better than how Texas did in that game.
Sure. And then Ian Aspamonte, how hard has it become for y'all to teach the quarterbacks to hit those post routes? This arc is always drawing up with the way defenses are now poaching is a key word, from the backside from all these kinds of different coverages. So the idea of a poaching is traditionally you would have a backside safety that wouldn't be involved with this post for whatever reason. When you hear the word poach, it means a backside safety is now coming over to help out. So they're stealing, they're poaching the route. And so that's what we mean by whenever you hear the word poach, you can think that generally.
So here's this first example. The safety on the top for TCU, just under the watch on – yeah, that guy. If you're the safety in a two-high coverage like this guy is here, and you see the quarterback looking at the other side of the field and reading that, and you don't have anything on your side of the field that's threatening you, you can start to get over there to defend because you know that they're probably trying to get a post behind their guys from the other side of the field. And so you just get over there and help. And it's funny, both of my examples that I have of this, Quinn actually gets picked by the corner that's trailing the route, which just goes to show that the problem was not so much the poacher, but go ahead and let it roll.
So the concept is going to come this way at the bottom, and then it's going to arc inside, I assume. I haven't seen this yet. And then somebody from the backside defensive player is going to come steal or poach that inbreaker. And it used to not be the case. These guys were kind of detached and would have to focus on whatever's happening conceptually on this side, and they wouldn't really even pay attention to what's going on the front side of the play. But that's changed, and it's frustrating for quarterbacks because from like day one, you're taught – two safeties, middle field open, one safety, middle field close. It's kind of a basic tenet of quarterbacking and pre-snap reading. But now that doesn't really matter anymore. That can lie to you and get you in trouble. So kind of a foundational quarterback concept has been solved at times by running this style of defense. Watch the backside player steal something coming from the front side. See right here. So he flies out of frame at the top, and he comes and steals this post. Yep. And they did it well. He ends up taking the high side, and then the guy undercuts him. But that's what's frustrating now with these posts is you're expecting a one-on-one matchup, and you're getting guys stealing it now. So frustrating. Play action. Disaster. All right, and then you have another backside instance here versus Arizona State. So the play concept, I assume, is down here, Ian. This is going to be your main route, and then someone's going to steal from up here or vice versa.
Vice versa. Jeez. It's from up top. It's from up top, and they steal from the bottom.
Okay. So something's going to be breaking inside from the top, and then somebody from the backside is going to work and steal this route.
Again, technically,
a corner, right?
Yeah.
That's tough, man. And you get popped trying to land it. So, and then this is when Makuba does it for us, right? The play we broke down a couple episodes ago. Yeah, the backside seam player in cover three can take an over and free the safety. This is the one we broke down, right, Ian? In the past?
This is the one, yes, recently.
So Makuba will drop back to play side. So it works for us too, right? Everyone runs it.
Not everybody.
Well, they should run it, yeah.
They should. More and more will, yeah. For sure.
So what we mean is the post was generally a pretty safe bet for a big play, and teams are disguising it now too. You saw how we had Makuba low in the concept, and then he, you know, Beck's not expecting him to work over there, and he does, and because he does that, we get an interception.
We have a blasphemy in the chat.
What?
Joe Cook says Penix was on Burrow level. No.
Both of those players played bad pass defenses, but they were transcendent on that night and others. Texas had its 2023 defense issues, but was 6 in DFEI. Colt torched Mizzou, who was 42 in DFEI in 08.
DFEI, it only, if you never play a good passing offense, DFEI does the best it can. You know?
So. I mean, I thought Penix that night, it didn't seem like the ball could hit the ground. And there was even plays where, like, it wasn't even coverage. It was just, like, the receivers were on. And that was one of the most special kind of receiving cores. I mean, they had three guys, Polk, McMillan, and Odunze. So I thought that was a special team.
But we watched them a week later, and Michigan shut them down.
It's true. But I think what Joe's saying is just on that night, it was – they were pretty transient. Like, that was a combination of their scheme, our weaker pass defense, and also just having an electric night. And it all just kind of came together in one big moment, you know?
They were sharp, but Texas was not good. Like, they were bad. There's a reason that they, like, turned over the whole secondary after the season.
Yeah, that – I mean, yeah, everyone – yeah.
Like, how many starters were, like, transferred out and were replaced?
Yeah. They were like, Jaron Thompson, we love you, dude. Terrence Brooks, we love you, dude.
You got how well can you see this?
If you keep it there, I can see it well.
All right, I'll bring it back in a minute when we explain this. I've done some quick
diagramming.
Impromptu graphics for explaining what we're about to get into.
Yeah. Okay, so what was your...
So here's the problem is that you just explained. Sark wants to throw post routes, but modern defenses will steal the post from a guy on the other side of the field. And it's extra devious, not only because it helps teams defend some of these double vertical patterns that have tortured off defenses for the last 20 years or whatever, but also the quarterback, it's really hard to read something on the right side of the field. And then a guy from the left side of the field is coming from outside of your vision into the throwing lane. Like, how do you beat that? How do you anticipate it? How do you beat it? So that's the question that we're trying to answer. And I specifically asked this of Bamonte because I've been noticing and learning more and more about this coverage technique. And I'm like, hey, how much of Texas's problems relate to teams that are doing this?
And this is Bamonte's response.
Yes.
Certainly, I think you try to get in the world of just repetition and landmark, try to hold each other accountable from both sides, quarterback to receiver, and then trying to adjust to schematic things defensively, robbing from the backside and doing those things and trying to have answers for that stuff as well. Kind of a combination of a lot of things.
So the big thing that stood out to me here was landmark, which is – if you teach your quarterback and your receiver on the post route to run to a specific point of the field and you hit the receiver there, then the guy's not going to get to it. So here's my...
I can try to make this bigger for you. Let's see.
The one on the... Oh, God, I can't see.
I know, it's mirrored and it's flipped, so you're going to like have double confusion.
Okay. Here's the post route. If it cuts across the field... and this safety has a chance to get over and get it. But if it cuts deeper and more vertical down the field, this is, I have my, it's like mirrored image.
It's mirrored and backwards for you.
I can't do this. If you throw it deep enough, then the guy from the other side of the field can't get to it.
Yeah, because he's still coming from low enough.
Because he's coming from low and he's recognizing late in the process, I'm not needed here. I should get over there. So even if he realizes that, he's like sprinting. Do you have any chance of impacting the play? And if you make him come at a sharp angle down the field where he has to really flip his hips and run, and he can't even see the ball coming, and you make him, and you, if you, as we'll see it with Arch, just to cut to the chase, on Arch's post routes, they would guide the receiver further down the field than Quinn's, and he didn't lead them across the field as much. He kept them more on their own side of the field. So it was more of a vertical post and less of a
flattened route.
Less of a flattened route. And it was more, it was the hang time. I actually counted the hang time on the post routes. It was rather inexact science playing go on GIF and go one Mississippi, two Mississippi. But for sure, Arch's balls were getting there faster than Quinn's. And they were. So the idea is you practice the landmarks and you tell the receiver, you need to break off the post here and you need to get here. Arch, that's where he's going. That's where you got to throw it. And they obviously, they were just not good at it with Quinn.
Well, and Quinn too naturally puts more air on under seemingly every throw. Yeah. And the problem is if you put air under this stuff with a poacher, that's how somebody can undercut you and get the pick. So as long as you stay on a flatter trajectory of the throw and it gets there faster, you limit that. But anytime it hangs and you have a guy already on you and a poacher, now you're in more trouble. You're giving the poacher more time to get there.
So I asked Amante, he said that, and I said, is that something that would trip up Quinn? Sometimes it felt like the landmarks, he'd be trying to hit those, and then he just cut me off. And he goes, yeah, I think we would all be honest in saying we wish we would have been more detailed in terms of our landmarks and our throwing spots. And it's like anything. There's instances where there's a lot of factors that play a role in it. It's not always the quarterback or the receiver, whatever the case may be. So obviously, if your quarterback is pressured, he may not be able to have the right timing on the throw if the protection's not good enough. That surely happens some. If the receiver runs the wrong line and the quarterback throws the right one, it's not the quarterback's fault. If the quarterback misses his spot or guides the receiver to the wrong spot. But here's the thing. We watched Quinn attempt a ton of these last year, and we watched Arch attempt a fair number. And one of them completed a bunch of them, and the other one almost never did. And so it's like, I totally believe that the receivers did not always hit the right spots. But clearly, Quinn struggled with the specific line of the post and hitting it to the right spot. Clearly.
Yeah, and the whole, in your whole deposition, you're trying to isolate, and he's just like, he will not let you isolate. He's playing good political game. You asked, does it, the landmark, have to change every week with the defense, or is it something y'all have a consistent, if we hit it here, we're good? And Bamonte responds, yeah, I think there's definite landmarks to it, and then you got to make adjustments to who you're playing that week. There's no question about that. If you got a fast safety, a fast poacher, you got to probably adjust where you're trying to hit, right? If you got a slow safety, you can adjust where you're going to hit. So it's
– or a smart one too. Maybe
– the most dangerous of them maybe all. Maybe
more important, yeah.
Yeah.
Because Sark targeted Caleb Downs in 2023 because he knew, like, probably Downs is unbelievable range. But Sark was like, I'm going to get him going in the wrong direction. And just turn that speed against him. And so down, and then people have reported, like, on the sideline, Downs was huffing and puffing.
Yeah.
Because he'd like run one way and then realize Sark had something else and then sprinting back the other way. And that's exhausting, obviously.
Yeah.
Taff, you would think, oh, let's go after Taff. He's slower back there. And he is a little bit. He's not one of the faster guys. But Taff is so efficient in his movements and his disguises.
And not wasting energy on bait concepts. So Bamonte gave you the pretty standard answers.
What I really took from this was that their plan is precise, throw it to a spot. And that's how, if we throw it, and then obviously, how do you avoid a backside poacher? If you throw it deeper and you throw it tighter, it's going to be a lot harder for him to get there. So that's probably what they're practicing, and that's just the obvious solution.
And if you play a Sark offense, I mean, this is going to be a main tool of defense. So if I'm any DC, I'm integrating basically like these quarter concepts into cover three now, if I'm not even in quarters. But it's – if I'm any defense, I'm installing this against Sark, because there's no question that that can be an answer for some of these concepts.
Well, I was last year. This year, I don't know.
We'll see.
Yeah.
And then this is the best play Quinn Ewers made all year. What is this one? A post?
This is the post. Clemson is going to do the backside poach from the corner in cover three. So the corner on bottom is going to get over and try to break up the play. Quinn, the safety bites down on the over route, and then Quinn throws it over his head on the post. Quinn does sort of pump it, which gives him a lot less time to hit a specific spot.
But does it bring that safety down?
It brings the safety down. Maybe he would have gone down anyway, I kind of think. Now that I've – in the moment, I was like, Quinn totally made the safety bite down. Now, later on, I'm like, he might have done that anyway, because that was Arizona State's whole game plan. But he hits the post. This was like the one post route Quinn hit last year. And – you can see it was in the air for maybe just a touch longer than you want. And it was a little more across the field than you want. But he got it in there. And you see, like, he was almost at the other hash. And I pinpointed below exactly how far down the field he was when he caught it. Which is, scroll down just a little bit, 37 yards from the line of scrimmage. That's not 37 yards in the air. You have to do some Pythagorean theorem to figure out how far the ball traveled in the air. But 37 yards down from the line of scrimmage to the catch point.
Yeah.
Arches, I went over a couple arch bombs, and they have less hang time. They tend to hit the receiver a little tighter, and they both hit deeper. Like one was – this one was 50 yards down the field, and then the next one was like, what was the next one? Scroll down just a little bit more. 43 yards down the field. So those are both deeper. I'm not going to do the Pythagorean theorem right now to figure out.
He put some air under that one.
Yeah, but look where it hits. Look where it hits in relation to the hash marks.
Right.
And how much further down the field.
So he's throwing from the opposite hash. He gets it to about mid hash.
Ball. They also, the poacher is occupied by a route, the top safety, and he's nowhere near it.
Yeah. Oh, we'll do it. You guys love when we talk numbers. You guys are big numbers guys, man.
I've done this before, not on live. It takes me a fair bit of time. Because the thing that's tricky about it is you see where on the spot, like, the quarterback is, and then the receiver when he catches the ball. And then I have to go Google the college football field dimensions so I can figure out, like, how many yards from the sideline is that? Yeah. So I can fill out all the angles of the Pythagorean theorem. And it's surprisingly time consuming.
Yeah. I'm not whatever.
Requires some guesstimation, and then you gotta pull up a square, open up another tab and pull up square root calculator, because of course I can't do that in my head.
So here's your final kind of thought on what it means. So executing explosive passing offense against modern defenses has become more difficult as defensive coverages have been modified to take away the most dangerous route combinations that were powering the explosive spread attacks over the last decade or so. Beating these defenses requires precise execution throwing down the field and some real throwing power to rifle the ball into tighter windows. It appears Manning will be the first Texas quarterback with the ability to consistently nail this down and unlock Sark's overall offense. So, boom, there's some optimism for you guys. There you go.
Texas, I think I am totally unafraid of projecting Texas to have their best offense yet of the Sark era.
even worried about wide receiver and offensive line?
Yeah.
I do too. I just think Arch is going to challenge downfield more often, make Sark's game plans pay out. I think he's going to be more aggressive in general. Then you add on top of that his ability to scramble on third downs when we need it, real runs, designed reads. I just think the menu is so much wider that you're going to be able to find something you like more often.
There's three things a quarterback can do that will make any offense extremely difficult to deal with. Hit bombs, boost the run game with option threat, and not turn it over or commit a lot of negative plays. If your quarterback hits those three check marks, you're going to be very explosive on offense. Like Dylan Gabriel, you'd watch him and it'd be like, I think he's doing pretty bad in the NFL, right? So far in training camp, I feel like I've seen reports that are like,
dude, training camp means nothing to me.
If your quarterback is bad in training camp, that's usually a pretty bad sign, right?
Yeah.
Well, whatever.
Maybe my difference between good and bad is just whatever dork was on the sidelines and recorded the clip. You know what I'm saying? It's just, I don't know how solid I'm gonna. In preseason is when I'm. I'll watch preseason.
Okay, that aside, Gabriel could lead receivers down the field and hit shots. He could run option plays enough to make you worry about him and have to worry about defending the quarterback. And he didn't throw a lot of picks. And he was like, because he was like a sixth year senior by the end. And he was, I was watching Oregon the other day because I was studying Tom Allen, who's going to be the new Clemson defensive coordinator, was at Penn State. And I was worried all year that Oregon was never going to be able to get very far with Dylan Gabriel because he's so small. And because I was like, he's going to accumulate hits in their offense. They're going to play these cold weather Big Ten games and he's going to crumble. And they did an amazing job protecting him. He had like way fewer carries. But you watch him and they would run a lot of option schemes where he didn't even end up pulling the ball, but they just made teams account for it.
And it breaks the defense.
And it just, the same with Will Howard at Ohio State. Like you just make the defense even think about it consistently and it boosts the overall offense so much. So you're making them think about an extra threat in the box. Okay, now they have to pay more attention to the box. Consistently hitting shots down the field. Well, now how are they going to pay more attention to the box and pay more attention deep? And so if you're doing those two things and yo-yoing them back and forth and you're not throwing picks or fumbling the ball, you're going to just torch most teams. And Arch Manning is better at both of those things than Gabriel Moore. He's better at hitting shots. He's better at being a plus one in the run game.
And then you hit that one run where it matters, like Howard versus us, or that backbreaker third down where you have everything covered deep because they're going deep, and then they just pick up the third down they needed on that drive. So you talk about that paranoia. Like the quarterback doesn't have to run it all the time, whether it's designed or scrambled. It's those heartbreaking moments when Howard gets that one run that gets you. Because you're eventually going to get lazy. And you make defensive ends and all these players super paranoid and insecure about their roles on the backside. And is he pulling? Is he not? So you can also delegitimize a lot of these really twitchy athletes from playing confidently. So it does a lot. I'm down with it too. I think even with some dysfunction, I still think this offense will be better. All right. You ready to talk star?
Yeah.
Let's get it. But before we do that, guys, let's hear a word from David McClellan.
I'm just going to say, guys, you probably need a fiduciary financial advisor. And I've got the guy for you. His name is David McClellan with Forum Financial. He works broadly and deeply with his clients as a financial life coach. And he should know something about coaching because he won several national championships as a swimmer for the University of Texas. He specializes in financial planning and has contributed numerous articles to Kipling on the topic of retirement tax bombs. So contact David today to be your fiduciary financial planner. and schedule a one-hour consultation to assess your financial situations. The free consultation is available, so just give him a call. The number is 312-933-8823. That's 312-933-8823. His email is also in the description below.
Thank you, David. So we've heard that Michael Taft has got some reps at Star, and you know, people have their opinions on yes or no about that. But dutifully, like Ian does, he goes, well, all right, let's actually just look at it and see what we can glean from actual tape and understanding of the schematics. So what do you think here? Of course, you talk about kind of the history here that we've had guys move around from star to corner. And Taft has played star for us a couple times. So why it does make sense for Taft to play at star. And a lot of it has to do with just the realities of trying to get the best players we have on the field. So just kind of explain that dynamic first.
Yeah. So part one is it's expected that the five best players in the defensive backfield are going to be Gilbo or Black, Muhammad, Derek Williams, Michael Taft, and Jelani McDonald. In particular, I think the main thing is that Williams, Taft, and McDonald all have the potential to be like all conference caliber safeties. So it's like you want to play all three of them as often as possible and not be subbing them around, not have the deal where it's like Trey Moore and Colin Simmons are two of your best players, but they play the same position, right? And then so then it's like, okay, which of those three safeties is going to play star? Well, Derek Williams hasn't really repped it as much, and he missed an enormous chunk of the offseason, and he's working his way back. I kind of think he might be the best option to play star, but it's a very mentally demanding position. You need reps to get it right. And we don't, he may not be ready to even try to take that on right now. He's just trying to get into football shape, right? Also, he's extremely rangy and effective playing on the back end. So maybe you don't even want to consider it because you're like, when we put this guy deep, he erases things in front of him. Okay. McDonald could do it, has long been expected to do it. But if you were drawing up the ideal position for McDonald, it would probably be boundary safety because it matches him up with the tight end more and allows him to be more of like a rover and an insert player in the box. And it's like, if you're drawing up the ideal way to use Jelani McDonald, that seems like that might be it. If he's amazing in coverage and can turn and run with slot receivers, then maybe nickel is a little better still because it uses more of the skill set. But I don't know if he can do that. We've never seen him do it. I've heard apocryphal stories about how he's capable of playing coverage, but he's never done it in games. And whenever they would use him in games at nickel last year, which is kind of a lot, but when they did, it was always against teams that weren't going to attack Texas that way. Finally, you have Michael Taft. Michael Taft got started at that position. He was a cornerback at Westlake. He's extremely smart. He knows all the positions. He'll do anything you ask of him. If it puts Derek Williams and Jelani McDonald at their best positions to play Taft at star, why not play Taft at star? That's the case. That's the positive case.
Yeah. And it's a good case.
The reason you don't do it is because it would be freaking terrible.
All right. So what's the case against? Because we've got the positive case. Why? What's wrong with that? And to me, when I kind of think in a quarters look and a two high safety look, you can help the nickel more. Because there's the one of the safeties can take two vertical. So this is what's interesting to me. Is this so? For instance, like in like quarters, I'm down with playing a two high safety defense. I'm down with playing a nickel as a safety body type because they generally are capped and have help vertically, unless the concept breaks it. But generally, that's the rule. Cover three to me is where you need the corner body most at nickel because you're going to have to take the slot vertically, meaning they're going to be on a vertical sprint and your foot speed now really does matter. So it's weird to me that we're going to go to a single high cover three style defense, but we're choosing a safety body. To me, that seems backwards. Does that make any sense?
Yes.
Okay.
You want, when you're in single high, you want a corner type at nickel. If you're in too high, you still would rather have sort of a corner type. And I'll show you why. Ready for another one of these?
Go, baby. It's going to go great.
Okay. All right. That's a flag football play. Don't worry about that one. Yeah, where's my finger? This is the one.
Okay.
If you are in too high coverage and you are in trips and you're facing trips and they have three receivers to one side of the field and the guy on the backside X is Jeremiah Smith, you do not want that backside corner to have to cover Jeremiah Smith without help. So you want that strong safety. You want him to choose this side, to stay on this side. Okay? Now on this side, that means, let's say they have Max Clair, and he goes up and across. Can't leave that for the Mike linebacker, so the free safety has to pick that up. Then you put whoever their next sensational slot receiver is, and you send him on a post route up the field. Who covers that? The star covers that one-on-one like a corner in a lot of space. This is the coverage. When they moved to quarters, they moved Jahdae Barron to star. And they played that coverage where the star would have to carry that down the field, and it was fine. And they would do it with Gilbo some, and it was also generally fine. Taft cannot ask Taft to carry a really good slot receiver one-on-one down the field on a post route without help inside. There's a lot of cornerbacks that you don't want to ask that of. A lot. And he's not a corner. It's like a whole another degree worse, right?
Yeah.
If you play him in single high, you have to worry about the dreaded slot fade.
Slot fade. So the X down here at the bottom of your screen is going to run a hitch. He's ideally going to try to pin this corner down with him. So the corner will match up. They're going to stay low. This H right here in the slot is going to then run a fade out here. So you're going to run away from the single high safety. So he's not going to be able to help. And then you're going to have your corner pinned down covering this X. And now you have one-on-one, unless they do some type of variation where the corner is allowed to play like a sail technique and drift back. And then you just hit the hitch and rally down. But the scary thing is this H, you get matched up with the star one-on-one and it goes outside. There's no corner help. There's no free safety help.
There's also just, you know, a slant, a dig, a juke route, anything. The star starts to worry about anything vertical. The weaker in coverage he is, and he starts backing up.
More,
And then you just open up a whole world of shenanigans underneath for quick, easy completions. And maybe Taft could play that kind of game where it's like, hey, you're going to throw to your slot 10 times. He's going to catch 9 balls for 100 yards, but we're always going to keep it in front of us. Could maybe get away with that. It's not great. It's not like the super winning formula, but maybe you can survive that pretty consistently. But when you're talking about like an Ohio State slot receiver, you can't even count on these. They're going to kill you.
Well, even if you have a corner type and too high safety, like you still have to be worried about this stuff. But this style of coverage with Taft, with any safety, is a scary proposition.
And I will say, I did some due diligence when I wrote this article. And I was like, I'm going to find examples where Taft faced a slot receiver in coverage one-on-one. There's the slot fade. That's funny. It's right there.
Yeah.
I drew it for us. I'm going to find examples where Taft faced a slot receiver one-on-one, and we can see how it went. My memory was that his change in direction and recovery is not quite twitchy enough for that to work.
Yeah, the ability to turn the hips and go. So this is Taft, right?
Hold on. I scoured game film to find examples. And what I found in almost every game I looked at that also matched my memory of the season was they would always position Taft specifically to avoid this happening. And teams would try to like motion guys or line up in different formations. And they would always line up to where either Gilbo was on the inside receiver Makuba was on the inside receiver, or Taft was on him, but he had a linebacker underneath to channel them up in a way that wouldn't like compromise the underneath coverage.
Taft could essentially play like a safety in that regard still and stay on top of it, and the underneath coverage would help.
Yes.
Drive him.
Yes.
So this is Taft, right?
This is the only time I found a play where he's like one-on-one with an inside receiver.
Okay, let's see. So right here.
Yep.
And then he's taken number two.
That's Antonio Williams, who's very good, but there are lots of Antonio Williams out there in the world. No offense, Antonio. See that? See that? He tries to position to kind of collision and reroute him.
Right.
And he just matadors him and goes right by him.
So he's trying to reroute him in insides because there's presumably safety help that's going to be coming over.
Yeah.
So he collisions him a little bit.
Kind of grabs him a little bit. Going to get a lot of defensive holding. You can do that more in too high if you're the nickel, because you can kind of bump a guy up. I remember Baylor got away with playing a lot of press quarters with this like strong, smart, white walk-on safety one year. And they got away with it a lot doing stuff like this. But he always had a like corner type safety behind him, and that's why it worked.
But here's the problem, right? What if this is Jeremiah Smith? So it's like you're going to formationally try to get, if you know that Taft is being helped in some regard deep and it's one high, and you know that the safety is likely going to have to come over here and help, now you're just guaranteeing these one-on-ones down at the bottom opposite of the strength to said corner. So the problem I worry about, you can solve for this stuff. You can limit these potential weaknesses, but it limits what you can do in other places of the field. It limits some of the coverages you can run. So that's where it ends up limiting your options versus having something more expansive.
Yeah. It limits what made Texas's game plan against Ohio State last year so good. And Ohio State got a tight end in the portal this year that can catch and run routes down the field. And that has been the missing ingredient that they've not had against Michigan the last 4 years. Because part of the reason Michigan would get away with too high coverage all day is that Ohio State didn't have this as a big part of the playbook, where they can get into four wide with the tight end flexed out and start to overstress the deep safeties. Ohio State tried to do that some, but they just did not have the dudes, and it really wasn't a part of their arsenal. With Max Clair, it could 100% be part of their arsenal in a way that it never has before. So you already need to kind of worry about that in this going into this game. And then to have to worry about that, and then to have a guy that can't turn and run with slot receivers one-on-one, it's too much. It's too much, Connor.
Yeah, I agree with you, man. As soon as I heard single high focus and then Taft at star, I was like, this just seems like the opposite of how you'd want to do this.
It also, even to get back to like everybody doing what they're best at, Taft is so freaking good when he's protected and he's supporting somebody else in coverage. He disguises insanely well. He's always efficient in his movements. He stays in the right spots.
He reads it well.
He reads it right. He hits super hard when he comes. He makes plays on the ball. I think he goes from being like, I don't know, all conference top caliber safety in college football to becoming like a liability if you put him in this position.
To me, and you're kind of in a precarious draft spot, right? Because you're not going to have the measurables, right? Teams are going to love you in every other regard. But then we put you at nickel, you're just going to look worse generally. So that, to going from like All-American safety to that too, it's like, that's why you hope Jelani can do it, man. Is willing to do it and can do it. Even though Jelani's good at boundary, so is Taft. That's where I agree with you. The Taft thing to me is like, it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't maximize well. but Jelani's a missing piece, right?
I think they could get away with it if they were playing like a ton of Tampa 2 and a ton of zone, and then having Taft at star becomes like not really a positive, but it's a lot better because he can just get all over the field and disguise it and know what to do. But you can't play Tampa 2 every snap against Ohio State. Like, it's just not.
Especially because they play Tampa on their defense all the time. So on offense, you can just be like, what breaks your defense?
Honestly, I don't even know if I want to see this against UTSA and Owen McCown. That's how down I am on it, generally.
So what's the answer, Jelani?
I honestly think that probably the best thing they can do is start Grayson Littleton.
Just play quarters.
No. Play single high with Grayson Littleton.
Okay.
And just let him develop over the course of the year. And
that kid's smart as hell too.
You're not going to get all your guys in the field unless you're in dime, or they can play dime. That's also.
But if you go with Littleton now you're having, you know, one out of your three great safeties not on the field.
Yep.
So.
That's the way the cookie crumbles.
Yeah,
they could play dime and play Jelani as a linebacker. If the other team, like if Ohio State is in 11 with Max Clair as their tight end, I would really think about playing dime. And like, let's make Max Clair prove that he's a good enough blocker that they can punish us for having Jelani McDonald as one of our linebackers. And then we play, and then Taft can stay at safety, and Derek Williams can play safety, and then you play Littleton or Gilbo or whoever at slot.
But yeah, that's another thing too. We mentioned that it's like, well, why don't we just put Gilbo back at star if he's having a corner battle as a whatever senior and is in all these battles, just leave him at star and then Kobe Black and Manny Muhammad outside at corner. You don't get all your safeties on the field like you want, but then the problem is then you have a lot of corner depth issues. But also to me, it's like play Gilbo at star. If corner gets hurt, someone gets hurt, then just move him to corner. It's a more simplified position. He's been learning it all offseason. So there's some things you could potentially do. Also, if you just let go of this idea, everything is centered around this. We have to get our three safeties on the field. It's like seems like this mantra. And if you just relieve yourself of a second of having to think like that, now how do you solve something? And maybe you find an answer there opposed to just being obsessed with having these three guys on the field all the time. We rotate all the time, man. You're going to get reps. You're going to make plays.
They could do it as just like they could do that if they are playing a team with 12 personnel. Taft at nickel against 12 personnel is great. That's awesome. No problem at all. You wonder why it wouldn't just be McDonald, but I don't know. Maybe now you have two guys that can do it instead of one.
And why does 12 personnel make a difference? Because there's not a slot.
Because there's not a slot. Or if they're creating a slot,
it's a tight end slot.
Well, they could do it. They could stack both receivers to a side. But there's so many ways to help now. And it's way harder to get isolated. So Justin just says, this feels like the staff overthinking the secondary or us overthinking standard cross-training. It's probably the second one. Yeah. For all these reasons, I don't think the staff is seriously going to end up playing Taft across from slot receivers.
Because of what we've said.
Because of everything I've said, the staff knows this. So, and they made, like, they'll deny it, like, in public. They're not going to say, yeah, you're totally right, that white boy cannot turn it around the way we need him to make that work. They're not going to say that, obviously.
It'd be crazy if they did, man. ESPN, baby.
And especially like you're like senior leader.
Right.
Amazing football player. To like just break him down like that.
That's why I don't like it. Like I want to see Taft in the absolute best position for Taft to go in the NFL at as high as he can go. Continue that success. I also just don't like it for Taft as the person. I want him to get all advantage that he can be given and be rewarded in every way he can for what he's done for us, you know. That's a huge factor. But Littleton, y'all mentioned Littleton. Ian mentions Littleton. Smart kid, man. The coaches have loved him. So hopefully he comes on. And, you know, it's really surviving Ohio State, right? And then you're going to get three games where you can experiment and get really good reps before you go into conference play. So it might be a tough go game one, but you can get a lot of these other answers figured out in those next 3 weeks after that.
Yeah.
Even though, so
my ideal game plan for Ohio State would be like play Littleton at star if he can hold up. If he's doing really good against Mosley and Moore in camp, just play him at star. Play a lot of single high coverage and blitz a ton and just get after and just ignore last year's game plan and instead focus on getting after Julian Sayin, who's, by the way, like 5'11" and has thrown 4 college passes.
He looked pretty decisive, though, in his spring game. I was actually more impressed with him on getting there.
If he's awesome,
then God bless him.
Okay. I mean, what are we going to do?
Exactly. But I do worry about the all-out assault because of his spring game. Like, it was quick concepts and that kind of stuff.
So
I worry about that's the anticipated route Texas will take, and they'll already have the counters ready. But I don't know what the inverse to that is anyways. What's the other option?
Okay. Or you do the other thing where you play super conservative and absorb the opening script, and then you get after him. There's only so much with a first-year guy. There's only so much that you can – there's only so many counters you can realistically, you know?
And you think it's the Ohio State fake – they're like, we're in a quarterback battle right now, dude.
They're always in an alleged quarterback battle, and we're never in a quarterback battle.
Yeah. It's – I was like, well, my eyes say that Julian Sayin's the guy. So
my other fear was that Ohio State, they have some big tight ends too besides Clear. Like some guys that'll block. So my initial fear was like they're going to come out and they're just going to pound Texas in the run game. And if they can do it, then they're going to win. And I still have that concern a little bit. But more and more I'm starting to get concerned of like, you know what actually would be worse? Is if they can get 4 wide and flex out Claire and just like hunt Texas safeties and coverage. That's actually much, much worse.
But that's also where I like Taff on that backside. Like any of those weak side runs, I like the idea of Taff to the boundary there too.
Well, I would like McDonald there too.
I do, but I know more about Taff in that regard, I guess. I'm more comfortable with what I know.
He's great. Taff is great. People are like me. I've heard this multiple times. People are maybe Texas is just putting Taff at star out just as a misdirection. They're not like shouting it. It's mostly us doing content every day, but have made probably a mountain out of a molehill.
And they make like a 3-sentence comment in a presser. And
yeah, they're like, McDonald's worked at star, Taff has worked at star, Littleton.
We're like, Taff worked at star.
Like, Taff is at star.
Yeah. So it's, yeah. As far as it being bait, not necessarily bait, because you're not going to waste practice time for that regard. But yeah, it could be absolutely cross training. So we'll see. All right, chat. That was a fun show. We got a lot of dense, good, informative stuff in. We learned that Ian hates the team. I think he said, what'd you say? 5 wins? That was pretty rough, dude. Hopefully we can figure it out, dude.
Worst case scenario, 4-8.
That's the floor.
The floor is like 8-4, right?
Yeah, 9 is about where I go with the floor because I just think
they could lose 4 games. In a bad case scenario,
bad case scenario, you can lose a lot because God forbid Arch goes down, you know. But it's like I still feel like you're worried about what, like the combination of AM, OU, Florida, Georgia, Ohio State, like those 5.
Those 5 are all totally losable games.
Yeah.
There's no way. It would be shocking if they won all 5 of those games, right?
Oh, yeah. I don't think anyone reasonable thinks they're going to win all 5. But the goal is, like, win 3 of those.
Yeah. And they're 10-2, which is just good.
Yeah.
I think I worry about like 2 and 3 is what I worry about.
Yeah.
And that's probably another game on schedule they could lose too. Honestly.
Well, that's the problem with the SEC is like somebody could rise up and punch you. But realistically, Sark's been pretty good about that. Like the teams that we're supposed to beat, we do beat. Even if it gets a little sketchy, like in the third quarter or whatever. So I don't worry about Sark as much with that. I just worry about when we're matched up with fairly equal teams, the outcome doesn't generally go that well. So I'm not super worried about, you know, the upset stuff, but I do need to see more wins when we're not just purely overpowering people with like a scheme or having better players.
Just got to make the playoffs. Just whatever it takes.
And I'm adjusting my thoughts, man. Like I'm not thinking of it like the old school football where like you need to go undefeated. Like I think that's a thing of the past. I don't think that's what modern football is going to look like in college football. You know, like 3 losses with a schedule like that sucks, but I'm not super mad at it. And I say that until we have the 3 losses and then I'm going to be on the lives pissed off. But yeah, Chad, thank you. Ian, thank you. You know what you guys should do? You should go to InsideTexas.com. You can get all the latest team news, practice notes, all of that stuff. Of course, recruiting. I think we had Jake Kruhl announce that he's going to announce on the 12th, and it was originally going to be in October, so moved off his spot. So pay attention to that, the edge that we're in a battle with, I think, for OU. Also, it's weird, man. We're not in a lot of head-to-heads with OU. It used to be half of our battles were with OU. What happened to OU, man? That's just such a shame for those guys. But anyways, guys, join InsideTexas.com. You can get Inside Texas for $1 for your first week. As a bonus, your membership includes a complimentary year to The Athletic. Buy Paul's book. All the links are in the description if you want the physical or you want the digital. Chat, thank you. Ian, thank you as well. This was IT Live, brought to you by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Have a wonderful day. Peace out.